Hello and welcome to the Muni Lowdown. My name is Paul Graves and I'm the managing editor for Debtwire Municipals. Today's podcast title is The Heat is On. Joining me today is Kunal Kamal, one of our great journalists, and our special guest, Morgan Zabao, Community Heat and Health Information Coordinator for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, also known as NOAA. Kunal, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks for having me again, Paul.
And Morgan, a special greeting and thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. Excited to talk to you all about this.
Morgan, why don't you first start off with a little bit about your background?
Absolutely. So I have been working for NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, for a little over 2 years now. But prior to working for NOAA, I got my master's in public health with a focus on climate and health because I knew that this was going to be one of the biggest issues that we were going to be facing, not only in our lifetime, but for future generations as well. And so wanted to know as much as possible about this field. And within that, kind of got on the extreme heat path as my passion. Like I said, I've been doing this for about 2 years with the federal government. And it's been such a wild ride seeing, you know, the different ways that communities have been able to really go headfirst into working on this issue.
All right. So I'm looking forward to this. So in our last podcast, we set the framework for future ones on climate and weather event topics. In this podcast, we're going to focus on the insidious nature of extreme heat on municipalities. As with other climate and weather events, extreme heat is increasing in frequency and intensity. Morgan, can you tell us a little bit more about the Urban Heat Island mapping campaign and its objectives?
Absolutely. We started this project back in 2017, and I'll even take a step back a second and explain what urban heat islands are, because some people may not be familiar. Urban heat islands are the fact that cities are typically much warmer than your nearby rural, more vegetated areas due to factors of the built environment. That's the fact that cities have a lot more asphalt and concrete, your taller buildings, you've got all the car exhaust too, and all of that radiating heat stays during the day and gets radiated back out over the course of the day and the night. And that has led to cities in some instances being 15 to 20 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than, again, your nearby rural vegetated areas. And since more than 80% of Americans live in cities, this is a large population of people that are experiencing hotter temperatures. That's kind of why we were focused on urban, our cities in the U.S. with this project. But we started this back in 2017, and we partner with private sector company Kappa Strategies out of Portland, Oregon, to really look at the heat distribution in cities. How this project works is that cities will apply for our program, and when you're part of it, you're able to work with both of our organizations to be able to undergo this work. So it's just over the course of one day. So not a huge undertaking by any of the cities, not something that, you know, requires them to do for years and years, but it's working with local organizations, academic institutions, or the local city government in these locations to undergo this task. And one of the best parts about it and what makes it so unique is that it's a community science effort. So it's volunteers from these communities who are collecting this temperature data. And so what the volunteers will do is over the course of one day, again, they'll go out three times during the day, in the morning, the afternoon, and the evening. And these volunteers will attach this sensor that, again, collects that temperature and humidity data to either their car or their bike. And they'll drive around predetermined routes. And the sensor collects all that data, which is then able to produce a report. And this report then highlights how heat is distributed by neighborhoods across the city. And so it really helps local decision makers be able to know where they need to focus most to make sure that those neighborhoods are cool, not just now, but also in the future.
That's great, Morgan. I just wanted to understand what is the exact role of citizen science volunteers in mapping this heat stress? And also, what are the long-term implications of these findings, this mapping? And how can we improve participation from various municipalities into this program so that the data becomes more robust and more extensive?
Yeah, absolutely. Great question. So with the first one, the community science volunteers are absolutely essential to be doing this work. Because again, it's not your government scientists coming in, collecting data, and then leaving. It's people who are from these neighborhoods who are taking an interest in this work. And it's also educating them about the risks of extreme heat in their areas. And so hopefully it it kind of also builds this community of practice within each location that can be more ready to work with their decision makers to grow these community organizations and really make sure that extreme heat is a focus in these communities. It's been really great to be able to work with all these community volunteers and organizations. And I myself got to participate in one of our campaigns in Montgomery County, Maryland last year and just had an absolute blast getting to ride around. I rode around with a father and a young son, and the young son was I think, about 10 years old. He was just so excited to be participating in a science activity. So it, again, just really the education aspect and learning more about how heat is impacting their communities. And to your other question too, about how we can kind of improve some of this too, you know, like I said, it's just over the course of one day with these temperature sensors. And we know that a lot goes into the temperatures of that one specific day. Maybe there's a little bit of cloud coverage, or maybe it's not like the exact hottest day of the year. We try to obviously plan around those things, but putting in place some longer term sensors is definitely a way that cities have gone through their urban heat island mapping campaigns and continued it because they want to see maybe over the course of like 3 months or the entire summer how the urban heat island effect and extreme heat is impacting their city. So obviously having more data just really leads you to understand better how things change. And especially if cities are starting to implement some of these cooling solutions with a variety of different things that they can do, they can also see how it's helping. And maybe that those neighborhoods are getting a little bit cooler than they were 5 years ago. So there's definitely a lot of things that cities have done to be able to go off of the mapping afterwards too.
So Morgan, when did the mapping campaign begin? How many cities are involved as of right now? I know you're not a municipal finance expert, but can you give us some sense of the different types of costs that municipalities would have to consider or think about as they try to deal with extreme heat?
With the first part of your question, we started this mapping back in 2017. And since then, we've mapped more than 80 communities across the country with a huge geographic distribution too. And we've also mapped two international cities for the first time just earlier this year. So we did that in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, and Freetown, Sierra Leone. And we will be mapping Santiago, Chile in early January of next year. So we've been able to map a lot of cities and again, really learn a lot from these communities as well. But to your other question, there's a lot of things that go into what extreme heat is impacting, especially at the municipality level. The first one being human health, of course. So you've got the impacts on the healthcare system. The CDC recently put out a report that approximately 1,220 people die in the U.S. from extreme heat every year, and tens of thousands of people are hospitalized with heat-related illnesses. So you've definitely got an impact to the healthcare system. And you also have to think about the impacts on infrastructure. So we've seen railways buckling. We've seen planes having to sit on the tarmac because the planes are too hot to be able to take off. We've also seen schools closing because of the heat. There's been a lot of schools. I know it's been in like Pittsburgh and Detroit where the schools may not have the updated infrastructure and AC to be able to support these increasing temperatures. And so they've had to send students home and or just have go to remote learning for the day. And then, of course, impacts on the utilities and the electric grid. As temperatures are increasing and people are continuing to load the grid with more AC, you know, we've seen rolling blackouts in some locations, which can cause a variety of different issues. And then in addition to that, on kind of the agriculture level, we've seen crop loss, we've seen livestock death, as we know that extreme heat really impacts livestock as well. And then labor productivity losses, especially on extreme heat days, you know, if people aren't able to go out into the fields or aren't able to do construction or needing to take a break, that's labor productivity losses. So there's a lot of different ways. And then you have to also think about how extreme heat has a lot of cascading and compounding effects too. So cities that are dealing with extreme heat and wildfires, extreme heat and drought, extreme heat and hurricanes. So there's so many different impacts. And you know, a lot of it does depend upon your region and your location in the country, of course, but there's definitely a lot of things that municipalities will need to be thinking about now and in the future with extreme heat.
So Morgan, in particular, how does extreme heat affect vulnerable communities?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's a lot of different ways. We know that while extreme heat impacts everyone, there are people who are definitely more disproportionately impacted to the effects of extreme heat. And there's a lot of different populations that fall into that route. We know that young children are one of them because they're not able to thermoregulate their body the way that adults are. So, and also they're not necessarily able to communicate the same way too. So they may not be able to tell their parents that I'm feeling very hot. And so we've seen a lot of issues with young children with heat. Older adults kind of on the opposite, you know, as they're getting older, maybe they're living alone. Again, maybe their body not being able to thermoregulate the way it used to. But there's also a lot of populations too, like people experiencing homelessness. We've seen a lot of deaths in people experiencing homelessness, people who are incarcerated. We also have to think about our indoor and outdoor workers, athletes. I mean, there's been so many stories of, especially, you know, at the high school level with football players who may not be able to get a break and are experiencing heat stress events. And then we've got people with disabilities, people with mental health conditions or chronic health conditions too, if especially people who've got maybe some cardiovascular issues, kidney diseases. So there's a lot of people that unfortunately can be highly impacted by extreme heat. And so it's really making sure that at the community level, at the federal level, really at every level, that we're making sure that these populations have everything that they can in place for when extreme heat events do happen.
Wow, that sounds a bit scary. And also, like, we are recently getting record-breaking heats every month. Even September was the hottest month for Earth on record. In this light, what kind of significance does mapping urban heat islands have in addressing climate-related challenges for municipalities? Can it help communities in the work of reducing emissions and adapting to unavoidable local impacts of climate change?
Yeah, another great question. Being part of the urban heat island mapping campaigns, again, from these 80 plus cities, by having that data report and that really outlines, again, where the hottest neighborhoods are, it helps those decision makers when, you know, it comes time to, if you've got this pot of funding and you're trying to decide which of the neighborhoods you're going to implement maybe some tree planting. By having this map that shows, okay, neighborhood A is a lot hotter than neighborhood B, and here's all the impacts that go into that, it really helps, especially when it comes to those decisions of, okay, yes, when you're thinking about your cost benefit analysis and what's going to be the best for your community, and again, thinking about your disproportionately impacted populations, this data can really help make those decisions. And in the 80 plus communities that we've mapped, we've seen so many of these communities that have started or have been implementing some cooling solutions based on that data, which has been really great to see.
Morgan, yesterday when we had our pre-production meeting, you talked about a term, tree canopy. And I was wondering if you could explain that more and its role in climate mitigation and adaptation strategies for municipalities.
Kind of generally speaking, tree canopy is a part of the city that's shaded by trees. But more specifically, if you're kind of looking down over your city, it's looking at the tree leaves, the branches, that's really covering the ground. And that's considered tree canopy. There's an organization called American Forests, and they really recommend that municipalities have about 40% tree canopy to be a healthy city. The importance of tree canopy and making sure that you have trees in your cities is all of the things that it does. And so not only do trees provide your shade and can help cool your community, but they also do wonderful things like cleaning the air by absorbing air pollutions and releasing oxygen, reducing rainwater runoff and erosion, saving energy, and of course can improve health, as we know there's so many physical and mental health impacts that are tied with trees. So a really great way to address the urban heat island is your tree canopy.
What would be other climate mitigation and adaptation strategies for combating heat, in your opinion?
We've seen a lot of different ones, and you can do twofold. So you can do it with at the adaptation level. So what are some things that you can do right now to really start reducing your urban heat island impact? And we've seen a couple different examples with that. One is Las Vegas, Nevada. They took their data report and saw that a lot of their bus stops were in the hottest parts of the city. And so they were able to add shading structures over the bus stops to be able to provide relief to bus riders. So one example of a way that they're using some adaptation measures. Raleigh, North Carolina saw that they had large amounts of concrete and asphalt that were contributing to the urban heat island effect, and they were able to get a grant from their city council to be able to add titanium dioxide to the asphalt to really help to decrease some of that reflectivity that's going back. And so those are just a couple different examples of people thinking of some innovative solutions with that too. But we also know that things like green roofs to be able to kind of decrease some of that energy load, you know, that's going into some of, especially in cities like New York and Chicago that have especially so many large buildings. But on the mitigation level too, you know, it's thinking about how we can make sure that our cities are resilient in the future and for our future generations. And we've seen a lot of cities that have been able to start building specific heat action plans. A lot of cities have climate action plans, but we're starting to see more that have heat action plans that are really specific to how are we going to be addressing extreme heat. And one of those cities was Seattle, King County, Washington. Their Urban Heat Island report showed over a 20 degree Fahrenheit difference between neighborhoods. And so they were, and especially with the Pacific Northwest heat dome that took place in 2021 that killed hundreds of people in the Pacific Northwest, they were quickly like, we need to put together an extreme heat mitigation strategy. So it's been great to be able to see so many of these cities starting to think about heat, not just now, but also for future generations as well.
You talked about tree canopy before, and I'm just, in our coverage, we cover places around the country. And I'm wondering, is it different when you think about prioritizing climate mitigation and adaptation strategies in places like Las Vegas and Phoenix versus maybe a Chicago, Miami, New York, particularly in places where drought issues might be pretty significant? Is there a one-size-fits-all approach to climate mitigation and adaptation, or is it something else?
Yeah, I think we wish there was a one-size-fits-all because that would be a little bit easier. It's really community specific and dependent. And again, because of maybe the different climate factors that you're also dealing with, like you mentioned, with extreme drought, or you're having, you know, also having to think about hurricanes or just different impacts as well. So there's not one size fits all with that. And also thinking about the different populations you have to keep in mind as well. And so specifically for something like tree canopy, it can be regionally specific. And if you're dealing with water supply issues, maybe massive amount of tree planting may not be your best mitigation strategy right away. Maybe it's something else. And maybe you also have to think about the specific types of trees that you need to be planting, not just any tree would work in that specific area. So a lot goes into these adaptation and mitigation strategies, but I think we've seen such a wide array of different strategies that people across the country, regionally specific, are taking that we've been able to kind of look at all of these different efforts that people can take. And some of them, of course, cost more than others, or some of them take longer to build. So even, again, going back to tree canopy, trees aren't going to sprout overnight and grow into massive trees. It takes decades sometimes, and also making sure that you have people to take care of those trees. So much goes into really thinking about how they want to move ahead with these strategies.
So a follow-up on the tree canopy issue. If it does take decades to get trees built, what can communities do in the meantime as they're waiting for that tree canopy to become a reality?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And I think we're also starting to see that right now with the USDA, the Forest Service. They were put out billions of dollars in grants with the Inflation Reduction Act. And we're starting to see that cities have been awarded this money. And so cities are really starting to think about how they're going to be doing this right now. So I'm excited to see what they're going to be doing, especially in kind of that time waiting process of having those trees built. And one example, I know Toledo, Ohio, they were part of our Urban Heat Island study this past summer, and they did receive that grant from the Forest Service. So we know that they're going to be using the Urban Heat Island data again, we're knowing where those hottest neighborhoods are to also help where they know that the trees need to be planted more than maybe other neighborhoods. So it's exciting to see where they're going to go.
So Morgan, a lot of our subscribers are always interested in the future. So I have one question for you. So the year 2023 is now on track to be the warmest year on record. So what are your predictions for the next year? And also, I just wanted to know, what were the most surprising findings from the Urban Heat Island project for you personally?
Yeah, with 2024, you know, it's going to be hot. And I can't touch too much on some of the projections necessarily for 2024, but I will say a good resource for people who want to learn more about heat and what projections will look like in their communities. We have a great website, heat.gov, really easy to remember. And right on that front page, we have information about projections and what your community could be facing by 2050, by 2090, but also using projections from NOAA and the National Weather Service to understand what 3 months out, what 1 month out, what 2 weeks out will look like in your community too. So there's a lot of great data that kind of indicates what temperatures are going to look like in the future for us.
That's great.
But for some of the data with the urban heat islands, again, some of the data that has shown temperature differences of over 20 degrees is always very stark and very scary. You'd hate to think that neighborhood A is 20 degrees hotter than neighborhood B just because of a lot of the impacts of the environment. But I will say an additional interesting one was we mapped Manhattan and the Bronx back in 2021, and the project leads overlaid historical redlining maps over the map of Manhattan and the Bronx with the heat distribution and saw that areas that were historically redlined were much hotter than some of the more wealthy, affluent areas, especially kind of around like your Central Park was so much cooler than your areas more towards the Bronx. And so it was just so stark to be able to see how inequities were playing into this too. And so with that, we've also built a tool also on heat.gov that takes the heat temperature distribution data and overlays with different social economic data as well, and really understands how inequities play into heat as well.
Well, thanks, Morgan, for sharing your work with the Urban Heat Highland Mapping Campaign. We plan to continue to build on our understanding of the implications of weather and climate risk on municipal bonds and strategies for navigating these challenges. To our audience, I hope you found this podcast to be informative. Please support us by liking, sharing our social media posts, and subscribing to Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Until the next time, thanks for joining us on the Muni Lowdown.